A podcast of the cinema
brought to you by you
and listeners like you,
right? The maybe not by you yet, maybe you have not joined our club yet.
No,
we'll talk about that later in the show when it's time to sell you something.
We'll talk about why you oughta.
What happy Outfest, Alonzo Duralde.
Thank you,
who's
Dave
the
White.
Editor's Who's the review, the movie review editor at therap.com.
Close enough.
And also senior programmer of Outfest.
That's right.
Which is why I say to you, happy Outfest.
Which is in progress as we speak.
How tired are you?
Well,
Are you quite tired? Are you extremely tired?
I'm quite tired, but I feel like I've gotten some good catch-up nights. Because
you slept in this morning.
Yeah, well, as much as one can on lawn mowing day.
It's every day.
For the building next door.
Every day is lawn mowing.
Lawn mowing day. You're Dave White of Garbled Syntax.
Mm.
So just to break it down, I got off a plane on Tuesday.
Yes.
Coming back from Karlovy Vary, which was like a 12-hour flight from Zurich, and having been somewhere that was 9 hours ahead of Los Angeles.
I drove all the way out to the airport to get you. A, to save money on a Uber, because I don't like it. And B, so that I could take you, after you landed, to Pan's. Because I was in the mood for some of their cake.
Mm.
They have really amazing cake at Pan's, which is this... It's a diner.
It's an old school diner.
On the way back from LAX.
If you're a fan of Googie architecture, it is a prime local example.
They were closed.
Yes.
I was so unhappy. We wound up going to the Magic Johnson's Fridays.
Yes.
Magic Johnson bought a TGI Fridays. I don't know if anyone else has ever been allowed to buy a TGI Fridays, or if all TGI Fridays are... franchises owned by individuals?
I suspect that they're franchises, and for the most part, going to, you know, Ed Schmielman's Fridays would not be a draw.
Right.
But Magic Johnson Fridays would.
Magic Johnson Fridays is right across the street from Pan's.
Yeah.
And so, because Pan's was closed, we went to the Magic Johnson Friday. We got the steak and lobster special.
Yeah, I kind of think steak and lobster should both be in quotation marks, but...
We got a small steak and a tail of a lobster.
Mm-hmm. It was skinny lobster, lobster model.
It's the cheapest item on the menu with purchase of beverage.
True, that's true. It was,
and that's why I like it.
And who doesn't? I guess people get water, but like, who doesn't purchase a beverage with a meal? I
very often do not.
Hmm.
I very often have just water.
Yeah,
because what other beverage? Any other beverage you get is going to be either booze, or
tons of sugar,
and true. Caffeine. It's like 7 o'clock at night. I don't need the 40 grams of sugar and 3 cups of coffee strength Coca Cola
with Bailey's in it.
With my special
that Friday's offers
steak and lobster special.
Anyway, so then that night, I think I slept a good 12 and a half hours, which was great because I was getting weird middle-of-the-night insomnia / jet lag while I was in Karlovy Vary.
Yeah.
But that was a fun trip, and I'm glad I went. A beautiful festival. And I wrote several reviews for The Wrap that you can read there, as well as my interview with Charlie Kaufman, which
right.
was very cool.
How was he?
He was very nice.
What was he wearing?
He dressed kind of tweedy.
Right.
You know, I think he was wearing like a blazer and pants. And, you know, no tie, but like a dress shirt. And, you know, I was nervous about that one because he's clearly super smart, you know, and he made he made my...
And you're super dumb, so that, yes, I can understand.
So I was very intimidated about that. And he, you know, he made my favorite movie of the millennium so far. Right. So, right, you know, it was Snake in New York. So I was nervous. He could not have been more charming and more forthcoming. Like, I was amazed at how frank he was in the interview about how he's got a hard time getting money to do projects because... Synecdoche didn't make money, and apparently Anomalisa didn't make money either, which I really wasn't aware of. He brought that up.
Between Synecdoche and Anomalisa, what is there?
That's it.
He hasn't.
Those are the only two films he's directed, and I don't think he's I don't think he's written for anybody else since he started directing. The thing that I had meant to ask him, and I forgot to, was because he made a mention about like other projects that he wants to do and like how it'd be easier to get it made if Spike Jones were directing as opposed to him or whatever.
Yeah.
I meant to ask him if, like, you know, Billy Wilder or Preston Sturges, where it's the thing where, okay, I'm tired of other people directing my scripts. I'm going to direct them from now on. And then do you not let anybody direct your scripts after that point? You know, is there a hard pivot there?
Right.
I forgot to ask him about that.
Oh, I figured that would be a... Why did you fail?
It was on my list of questions, but the conversation went in another direction, and I'm a believer in going with the organic flow of conversation. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I'm very happy with how the interview came out. So go read it at the wrap.
Well, I believe in jerking the conversation back onto the direction I wanted to go in forcibly.
I felt like he was giving me such good stuff that it was better to just go with it.
How else was the Czech Republic?
It was beautiful. Karlovy Vary is this spa town, which in my mind I was expecting it to be like 8.5, where everybody would be walking around in sheets and there'd be like all these sort of marble things. Not true, but there is like a thermal spring there, and there are these little... And
do you get to just jump in it?
No, I mean, not that I saw, but there were different pockets of it, and this like a lot of European cities, you know, certainly I've seen this a lot in Spain. There will be these little kind of public water fountains,
yes,
not in the sense that we have them, but like just in the middle of a square somewhere, this little sort of thing, and people would be refilling their water bottles there,
yes,
and a lot of people sort of swear by the Karlovy Vary water. It's very highly like alkaline or something,
okay, like diamond water,
for instance. But I was also kind of tipped off that it's kind of gross, so I never actually tried
it. Wait, who told you it was gross?
Some people that I had talked to who'd been to the festival before, they're like, ugh, don't drink the water. They're going to tell you it's good for you, but ugh. So I didn't actually...
Did they mean that it tasted bad?
Yes.
Or that it would give you the...
No, they just said it tasted bad.
The tummy.
Spanish tummy, as Monty Python would say. Yeah, no, they just said it tasted gross, so I didn't try it. I bought
Oh, you should have tried it, at least.
I know, I should have. I'm a bad tourist, but, you know.
You went to McDonald's, by the way.
I knew it was there, and I was like,
Sorry for yelling into the mic.
I find it kind of interesting to go to McDonald's in different...
No, countries. It's not. It is not interesting. We haven't even discussed this since you've been home.
No.
It just now popped back into my head. You went to a McDonald's. You've got an entirely other country and culture and all this interesting food that you could be eating.
I had a lot of different things that I also wanted to see.
What are McDonald's?
And I had never done the Euro thing of having a beer at McDonald's. I had a beer at McDonald's.
Who cares? You went to McDonald's.
I had a Czech beer at McDonald's. I hope that counts. It was a Pilsner Urquell.
No, it doesn't count. I'm trying to tell you. Stop it.
Well, look, the day that you leave the house and go with me places, we'll never go to McDonald's.
Listen, I would go to the Czech Republic with you. I would go to the Venice Film Festival with you. But guess what? None of those people are paying my way to go.
No, that's true.
They're paying for you to go, and that's why you're going. You go because they're like, oh, would you please come to our film festival, Alonso Duralde? Would you please come, and we'll put you up, and we'll fly you in?
Well,
that's why you go, and yes. I stay home. It's not... I don't stay home because I have, you know, an anxiety disorder that keeps me inside. I just...
They pay your
all right,
way.
All right. But also, they're not paying my way because of my sparkling personality. Oh, they want me to cover it, and I do.
Oh, yeah.
So,
but they don't listen.
So I go to beautiful exotic lands, and then spend all day in the theater watching movies, and then going back to my hotel room and writing about them.
They don't ask everybody.
I know.
To go, you're kind of a smoky something.
It's the outlet. They want the wrap to cover them, which they should.
Let me tell you something about outlets. Your outlet is a good one.
Yes.
One that people like.
Mm-hmm.
One that people know about.
Yes.
One that has some juice.
I'm proud to be working there.
Speaking as a person who worked for 10 years for an outlet of low prestige, of no renown, of almost anti-success, I can tell you that the outlet means a lot.
Well, sure.
I mean, it's why I quit. I mean, it's one of the reasons why I quit. Because this place that was of little consequence was treating me like garbage.
Well, yeah, that was so insult to injury.
You know, well, they...
When you write for The Wrap and you post yourself on Rotten Tomatoes, you are a top critic.
I'm a top critic.
As am I. And when I post my stuff from, like, so linoleum-knife.com, I am not.
You're not a top critic. Where was I going with this? Okay, so tell me all about the ironing room.
So I go to the front desk, and you know, opening night of this festival is black tie, and I was like, I don't have a tuxedo. And other people who went to the festival was like, wear a suit, you'll be fine.
Right.
So I packed my suit.
Was that the case where other people would simply wear suits?
There were other people in suits. I was not the only one.
Okay.
But I was in the minority. Most people did whip out their tuxes.
Do people own tuxedos? Is that...
Or do they rent them? I don't know.
A thing? Well, yeah, if you're in the Czech Republic and you can just go to your local, you know...
Genghis?
Yeah, you go to your local you
men's
know, Friar Tux. That's in the Burbank Mall, by the way. Friar Tux.
Oh, that's right.
It's in the Burbank Mall.
Please. Not far from Mademoiselle Men, if you
please go to the Burbank Mall sometime when you're in Burbank.
When in Burbank,
it's the good mall.
Visit the media center. So you know, I and the suit actually traveled okay. It wasn't super wrinkly. But the my shirt needed a little touch up.
Mm-hmm.
So
and a button.
So it turns out a top button, which somehow where it disappeared. That was fun. But anyway, so I go to the front desk and I go, "Hi, I wondered if I could get an ironing board, you know, up to my room so I could iron my shirt." And they're like, "Oh, well, you're on the first floor, so that's where the ironing room is."
Yeah.
I'm like, "Okay."
Yeah.
So and as I noticed by the elevator, they have all these little, you know, pictograms of like the swimming pool and the you can just. And there was a picture of an iron. I'm like, all right, I will follow the signs.
Follow the iron
to
sign.
The iron. And so I get there, and it's this little narrow room with two ironing boards and two irons.
And a bed of hot coals that you rest. You rest the iron on it.
And
then you pick it up.
They were plug-in irons, but they were both like chained to the outlet.
Yeah.
So that nobody would walk off with the precious iron.
Take it back to your room.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I pick an iron. It's really low on water, so I walk over to the sink. It just reaches the sink, mm-hmm. and I fill it up like, you know, 3/4 of the way, and I start ironing. And of course, immediately it starts leaking on my shirt.
Okay, great.
But yeah, so I luckily managed to, you know, I got the shirt serviceable enough
right.
for my evening out. I go to opening night and, you know, it's so weird the contrast because Outfest, there's a ton of people I know.
Yes.
There's a ton of people who know me, whether I know them or not, just because they've seen me do Q&As
and then
or
you
whatever.
You get to do that thing all night of, oh, hey.
Exactly. And I'm wearing a tag with my name on
right.
it, you know, so that's
and
a
they
big
may
deal.
Or may not be.
Right, exactly. Right. So I'm like, hey, you. But at Carlo Vivari, I forgot to wear my name tag to the opening night because I had a hard ticket and like an invitation, so it didn't occur. I didn't need it, but I should have worn it because nobody knew who I was.
Did everyone else have theirs on?
Scattering. Some people did. Some people didn't. And I heard like no English being spoken.
Oh yeah.
So I was just standing around, and then I thought, well, I should probably have a drink in my hand if I'm going to stand around and. foolishly, instead of getting, like, you know, water or something, I got a glass of white wine. And
what were you thinking?
Well, I thought it was not going to be a big deal, and I thought that, you know, the movie was going to start at 7, and then there would be food, and da-da-da. Oh, no. The festivities began at 7, which was, yes, like these several lengthy speeches in Czech.
Yeah, great.
Willem Dafoe getting an award and saying thank you and going back and sitting down again.
Good.
There was a cool thing. It was this, like, mixed media dance thing where they were, like, recreating the sort of early zoopraxinoscopes, you know, like the right, early, you know, film experiments of motion, and dancers in front of them kind of mimicking the motion, up to the point where they started showing the clip of, like, a racehorse, yeah, and a horse came on stage.
Oh, right.
A
on.
Trained horse, nice, came on stage.
Nice.
So that was pretty groovy. But anyway, and so then all that stops, and then the lights come back up, everybody goes back out to the lobby for more milling about and talking in Czech. Finally, we come back at 8 for the movie to start. So we don't get dinner until like 10:30 or something.
Which is when all y'all Europeans do that.
Yeah. So by this point, I have like a roaring headache because I'm dehydrated. I've had one glass of wine, yep, in the last 4 hours.
Yep.
And it was just like, get me out of here. You know, if I had been more on...
What was the movie?
It was this movie called Anthropoid. It's opening...
Oh, that's fixing to open.
It's opening in August. Yeah, yeah. It's about... It's based on a true story about the Czech resistance and how they managed to assassinate Hitler's, like, number three guy. This guy, the Butcher of Prague.
I'll go see that.
It was okay.
You know me, I like a World War II movie, though.
It was okay.
All right.
But, and had I been feeling better, I would have, like, rushed home and, like, cranked out a review that night, you know, even though it would have posted in the middle of the night, just because that's what the other trades did. But I was like, no one is dying for my Anthropoid review, so I went back to my
hotel. Ain't nobody waiting for that.
Exactly. I crashed, I got up early the next day, sent it in then, and, you know, no one cared. So that first evening I was just like, I had a headache. I'm surrounded by people that don't speak English.
Did you at least walk around the area hoping perhaps either to eavesdrop on conversations or, you know, just glean any information or stuff that you could?
I struck up a bit of a conversation. There was a guy, they introduced all the jurors as part of the spiel beforehand. And one of them was this guy from, like, the Tokyo Film Festival.
Okay.
And he wound up in line behind me when we were at the buffet.
Yes.
And so I struck up a chat with him, and we exchanged business cards and, you know, talked festivals for a bit. And then that was it. That was my one conversation for the entire evening.
What was the buffet? This is very important.
The buffet was, a lot of it was... round balls of glorp served
made
with,
of made of what?
I don't know.
Did you not eat one?
I didn't. God. It looked like big spheres of head cheese or something.
You go to McDonald's.
Oh, shut up.
But you won't eat the local,
okay,
the local food of glorp.
Can I remind you, I had a headache at this point.
What better way to get rid of your headache than to eat some glorp?
What I did eat was the roast pig that they were cutting sections off of, and it was just like lying on the table with a face still on it for the world to see. I took a picture of it, but I didn't put it on Facebook because I knew it would horrify
people.
No, you
sent it to me.
I sent it to you.
Fantastic.
I had some pig sections, and they were delicious. They were served.
Did you eat the face?
I did not have face.
The faces were the good set. Cheek.
I didn't get to dictate where it was being cut from. So, but they were serving it with horseradish, which I'd never had before.
Oh, yeah, how was that?
And that actually, it works. They had like a mustard and they had a horseradish. And I was like, okay, I've usually only had horseradish with like a beef.
I'm laughing because I'm just remembering the first time I was ever confronted with suckling pig on a table.
In Spain.
At your gigantic family reunion in Spain. And people just sort of like... I say it's time to eat the face of the pig. This is basically people putting their faces in the pig.
They were making out with the pig.
Yeah.
Anyway, but things got better after that. But you know,
you brought me home some good treats.
Yes.
I'm okay with the wafers. Uh-huh. Fine. Like, I'll eat those.
I was told that's like a local thing.
Oh, I know it is.
So I needed to bring the wafers.
I know it is. My favorite thing so far that you brought home was that milk chocolate bar.
Oh, yeah.
That had what are essentially saltine crackers in the middle of it. Yeah,
the Tuck, T-U-C crackers.
Yeah. A salty cracker.
Embedded in a chocolate
bar. Embedded in chocolate.
Yeah.
So good.
Well, the thing that I like best, which I devoured because it wasn't the thing I was bringing home to you, it was just something I picked up at the airport. I had to switch planes in Zurich.
I actually shouldn't call it a saltine. It's more like...
It's like a townhouse.
It's more like a club cracker.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kind of a buttery thing.
Yeah.
When I was changing planes in Zurich, and I just popped into a little store to get, like, more water and, you know, whatever, and they had these chocolate bars that were called Ovo Maltine.
Right, that you did not bring one home.
Which
you didn't bring me home one.
No, well, like I said, I was picking up a snack, and it was in that same. It's the same font as Ovaltine, so I'm figuring like, okay, so this must be like the original Euro version.
Yeah.
But in addition to making like the powder that you put into milk, they make chocolate bars with malt in them. Mm-hmm. I got a dark chocolate Ovo Maltine bar, and oh my god, it was so good.
Yeah, I bet it was really nice.
I brought you lots of things, so I don't want to hear about
it. You brought me some really fluffy lemon wafers.
Yeah, there.
Those are nice.
I know you like lemon. I brought you honey.
And you brought me honey that was made from a pollinated child?
I think it's just there's a kid on the label is all. Have you tried it yet?
The child on the label, I believe, is the processing vehicle for the honey.
He's the queen?
Like, the bees pollinate that kid. And they make that honey. And that kid apparently is a rosemary bush. Because that's what this honey tastes.
Is it really rosemary honey?
I don't know if it is, but it has that very bright, very sharp, almost spicy flavor.
Okay.
It's good. A strange honey. Like the kind
it's almost savory?
The kind you brought me back... from Italy.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really almost funky, very earthy, dirty tasting honey. And it
dirty, sexy honey.
And it tastes really great in super strong tea like Lapsang Souchong.
Uh huh.
Because it's this very strongly flavored honey and a very strongly flavored tea. And you would think those two things would fight each other, but they're really actually really great together.
Hmm.
I have put the Czech honey on toast so far.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I trust it going into tea.
You know what it might be good on?
Hmm.
If you make some more of those cheddar biscuits.
No.
No?
No, because the cheddar biscuits... I put the Old Bay seasoning garlic and butter. Yeah, yeah.
Honey wouldn't work.
I'm basically reproducing the Red Lobster biscuits.
Right.
And so, is this a movie podcast?
At some point, yes.
When do we start
and
talking?
I brought absinthe back. I don't know if we'll ever drink it, but they make it there, and it felt compulsory.
I don't know what I'm supposed to do with absinthe. I don't really want to drink it unless Kylie Minogue is going to show up.
I think that's part of the deal. Kylie Minogue appears before you.
She's in Los Angeles a lot, so if somebody could engineer her coming to my home...
while you're drinking
while absinthe. I have the absinthe, and she and I can have like a three-minute chat, it'd be real chill. I wouldn't freak out at all. Back to Outfest.
Yes.
Last night, for the documentary about legendary Los Angeles nightclub Jewel's Catch One.
Right.
You talked to Thelma Houston.
Yes.
And Evelyn Champagne King.
Yes.
I had a ticket to that show, and I didn't go because I was tired. And also because you're going to show it again next Saturday.
This Sunday.
This Sunday. And I thought, well, I'll just go to the Sunday morning show next week. I'm kind of tired. Well, ain't nobody told me that.
I didn't know either.
Evelyn Champagne King of the hit song Shame and Thelma Houston of the hit song Don't Leave Me This Way.
In the movie, they talk about Shame being a gay anthem.
Well, I don't know if it is or not. It's just a great song.
Well, no, but I mean, lyrically, it's, you know...
Like, sure, I guess. Fine. I just need to know how amazing were they standing next to you on a stage?
They were lovely. They were lovely.
Well, you sucked up to them by immediately saying, Divas, thank you for joining us this evening.
I was trying to come up with a good collective term to use on them.
That's a good one.
It seemed like the best shorthand. Yeah, no, it was the director of the film. It was Jewel herself.
Yes.
And Jewel's story is amazing.
She's quite the person.
Because, yeah. Like, you know, she not only started this legendary club and started in the face of, like, active sort of police interference of trying to, like, shut her down all the time. She also operates, like, a community health clinic.
Mm-hmm.
She is an acupuncturist. She went back to school.
Yes.
She runs a vegan cafe.
And she's, like, 80 or something. And those
Yeah. And, like...
I don't know if she's that old, but
she's late 70s,
she's pretty old.
And like, during the early years of the AIDS crisis, she was, like, operating these, like basically... giving people who were homeless a place to come and, like, eat, get, you know, be fed and stuff. Just an extraordinary story.
Yeah.
She's a real hero. So it was, it was just this amazing Q&A. And then Evelyn Champagne King talked about how she was so moved by the movie. She goes, but I didn't cry. And then she starts crying. Talking about how great Jewel is and how much she's meant to her, blah, blah, blah. And afterwards, she goes, oh, I'm so sorry. I cried up there. I said, we live for moments like that. That was great. Don't worry about it. It was very genuine.
We live for the following things in order. You. You crying.
End of list. it's been an interesting week because I did the Q&A after Strike a Pose.
Yeah.
So I had three.
Tell people what that is.
Strike a Pose is a documentary about Madonna's backup dancers from the Blonde Ambition tour.
The ones that were in Truth or Dare.
The ones who were in Truth or Dare.
Or if you're in Europe,
in bed with Madonna.
Right.
And it was really interesting. These guys just had fascinating stories. It turns out three of them were HIV positive at the time and keeping it a secret.
Yeah.
And just all kinds of things. It's a really, really fascinating story. And again, that was, and then, you know, so the three of them are on stage with the mother of the one dancer who died, and they've all got these amazing stories. And then Donna and Nikki, who were the backup singers for that tour.
For a long time.
Madonna's career. Yeah. They were in the audience, and it was a jamboree. It was really great. And then I got to talk to Michael Lannon.
And then Madonna showed up and demanded a fan. and to get those hydrangeas out of her face.
Exactly. and then I did a Q&A with Daniel Francese and Michael Lannon for Looking the Movie. And that was a lot of fun.
Yep.
It's been quite the weekend.
Daniel Francese and Michael Lannon, who are both...
taller than me.
1 foot taller than you. And you're not short.
Yeah.
Those guys are giants. I didn't know that about either one of them.
Yeah. They're statuesque.
I saw the picture of you standing in the middle, and I was like, what's going on? I have seen exactly two films and one short film.
Okay.
At Outfest. I saw the opening night film.
Right.
The Intervention.
Right.
Which is terrible.
It is not terrible.
It is a very terrible film.
No.
I
say terrible for really wretched movies. You can say it's nothing special and that it's not whatever, but I think there's good performances.
Why don't you tell people what it's about?
It is at least breezy and inoffensive. It's Clea Duvall's directing debut.
I like Clea Duvall.
And it's about a group of friends who get together for a weekend at a country house in South Georgia.
I like a country house.
And unbeknownst to one of the couples, everyone else is there to have an intervention with them to tell them that they really need to get divorced because they fight all the time.
Kobe Smulders and Melanie Lynskey and... Aaliyah Shawkat
and Natasha Lyonne
and Natasha Lyonne
and Jason and Ritter
Ben Schwartz Jean Ralphio in Parks and Rec.
Right.
What's his name? What's the actor's name?
I think it's Ben Schwartz.
I see him at Gelson's and I always want to go, hey, Jean Ralphio.
The next day at Outfest, all anybody was talking about was like, oh, did you see Jean Ralphio at opening night?
Oh, here's a little aside. Speaking of celebrities out in public, out in the wild,
mm-hmm.
I met Baskin Robbins last night.
Oh, God.
So, okay. So at like 5 o'clock, Gary Cotti texts me and he goes, "Let's go eat dinner."
Ben Schwartz, and Vincent Piazza is the other guy.
And I said, "Well, okay, we could go to Food Lab and have something healthy like a salad, or we could go to Top Around and have roast beef sandwiches and milkshakes." And he said, "Let's go to Food Lab, and then let's go get ice cream." So we go to So then we go to Food Lab, and we eat the healthy food. But then, not far from there, is the Melrose Avenue Baskin-Robbins, which is next to a laundromat that is constantly hopping with criminal activity, because this makes now 2 Sundays in a row that I've been to Baskin-Robbins and watched police there arresting someone. And it made me want to turn around and go away. So I was like, am I just going to get arrested by the cops just for showing up at this Baskin-Robbins?
Is there a sweep going on?
Yeah. So I'm standing in line at the Baskin-Robbins, and a lady in front of me drops a quarter on the floor, and I bend down to pick up the quarter, and I start laughing as I'm trying to pick it up because I'm fat, and picking up quarters off the floor is not easy sometimes.
Gallantry is a challenge.
Yeah, and she's like, "Oh, thank you," and I go, "Well, don't get your hopes up. I might not even be able to get this off the floor for you." I get it. I pick it up. I hand it back to her, and it's Selma Blair. And I was like, "Oh, here's your quarter." I did not say, "Oh, here's your quarter, Selma Blair," but I did think, "I really liked you as Kris Jenner on the OJ show."
Kris Kardashian.
And then I thought, and then my next thought was, "What's Selma Blair doing in the Baskin Robbins? Shouldn't you be eating ice cream at some fancier artisanal place?" And then I thought, no, she shouldn't. There's a reason that Baskin-Robbins is still around after all these many, many decades, and that's because Baskin-Robbins is so great.
Yeah. Even without an umlaut.
Yeah. Name a national ice cream chain.
Ben and Jerry's.
No. Like, that has stores.
Ben and Jerry's.
Standalone stores and shops and things. You've got Ben and Jerry's and Haagen-Dazs, but not as many.
Not as many locations.
Baskin-Robbins has... You can get a Baskin-Robbins going anywhere.
Yeah.
And you do. And there are. They're all over the place. Right. Still, when you would think that we had, you know, as a culture, maybe moved past the standalone ice cream shop.
Nope.
We have not. And Baskin-Robbins is the jam.
Yeah.
That's why Selma Blair was in Baskin-Robbins last night, dropping her money on the floor.
I've probably mentioned this before, but I have an ex who used to work at Baskin-Robbins. And
you have a husband that used to work at
Baskin-Robbins. I know that, but the difference is that my ex who worked at Baskin-Robbins, I guess the location that he worked at closed,
yeah,
and he got to keep the clock with the 31s. The 12:31s on it. That would be a cool thing to have in the house. The best.
We'd put it right in the... You know where we'd put it? We would put it in the bathroom next to the Taube Auerbach clock.
So there'd be a clock that human beings can read?
Listen, you would always think it was 31 o'clock if you had that Baskin-Robbins clock. So anyway...
Okay, you didn't like the intervention, but you also
saw... No, I did not like the intervention, and here's what I'm going to tell you why.
All right.
It's kind of about nothing.
I don't think so. I disagree.
It's a room full of white folks, and don't think that I have something against white folks. I'm one of them. But when that's all you got, you know... White people that you sort of kind of like from other TV shows and films. And their whole thing is, you know, what are our relationships about this weekend? Are we really meant to be together? Are these other people really meant to be together? Are we going to tackle the problems in our relationships?
Well, but that's not what the movie is. The movie...
That is totally what the movie is.
No. The movie is people... I mean, yes, it is, but it's not.
Yeah, see? That...
Okay, shush.
Meh.
The movie is people getting together because they're worried about these other people's relationships and being forced to realize that they're in no position to have judgments on other people because nobody else's house is in order either.
Speaking of houses, where the hell did they get that house?
It's outside of Savannah, apparently. That's what they said in the movie.
Did it used to be a plantation? Because it is...
quite possibly.
Staggering.
Yeah.
And they treat this house like it's... oh, that's just... you know, it's just any other house.
That's not true.
One person comments on how gloriously grand the home is.
Right.
Everyone else just waltzes in.
Right, but
like they should be there.
Okay, but here's the thing.
No one does any dishes. They spend a lot of time cooking.
No one's cleaning anything. There's a dish doing scene.
I wanted your next people to come and get them all.
You're a brat.
No, I'm right.
No.
It is a tedious
film. It is not. Look, I'm not defending it as this like grand masterpiece, but it's perfectly serviceable, and the performances are great, particularly Melanie Lynskey.
Melanie Lynskey is sweetly funny in the film.
She is, I think, hilarious, but at the same time...
hilarious is too much to say.
I think believable and grounded at the same time, which is a hard balance to pull off.
I want Clea DuVall to keep going and yes. keep making films.
Yes.
And to keep doing this and to do something different next time.
I think as first films go, this one's fine.
Like I say, I'm a big fan of hers. Just not right now. Here's what I did see.
Uh-huh.
That was pretty cool.
Yeah.
There's a Brazilian film and it's called The Cult. And I don't know what the title is in Portuguese. I'm sure it means The Cult.
Probably so, yeah.
It's set in 2040 in Recife. I don't know what town that is. But
it's a
Brazilian town. Where apparently everything is boarded up. And, or at least the parts that are boarded up are all you see. We have colonized space. And most of the folks in this future Brazil have gone to space to live. And they've all become vaccinated against sleep.
Right.
So when you go to live in space, when you go live in space Brazil, you don't have to sleep. But if you stay, or if you choose to come back, then everyone is still doing the quaint old custom of sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
But they're all completely bored because there's nothing to do back on
Earth
Brazil except have tons of sex. And so what happens is this young, and the only word to describe this kid is esthete,
louche.
He wears, you know, floppy blouses and lounges the day away looking at art books on an elegant couch in an apartment with, you know, grand high ceilings, but everything has an air of decay to it. There is nothing in the apartment is new.
It's a somewhat shabby rococo.
He has one current tech device, which is a like a computer that shows you your images in the air. It's not a screen. And that's the only nod to it being the future, really. There are no, you know, cell phones or anything. It's him and all these other gay guys. There's no indication that heterosexuals are left on Earth Brazil. He spends his days wandering the boarded up streets, cruising and being cruised.
Right.
And you never see sex happening. You just see nude bodies, a succession of nude bodies, lying in his bed.
Mm-hmm.
And then they talk about how they have to do everything in the daytime because at night it's too dangerous to go out. And they don't ever really explain why it's too dangerous to go out. And then he stumbles across a cult that has really gorgeous, elaborate, weird parties. Right. And he decides he's going to join those. And then something very abrupt happens, and then it's the end. It's a short, it's a feature, but it's only about 75 minutes long.
Yeah.
It is so strange and so dreamy. And clearly, I mean, for me, I say clearly, it may not be clear at all. This might not even be what it's about. But as I watched it, I realized that what I thought I was seeing was a critique of contemporary gay life as a cold, impersonal, technology-based existence where human contact is mediated entirely by the internet.
Right.
And the old-fashioned people, which are the people on Earth here, the old-fashioned gays are the ones who still want to go out and meet someone face-to-face and get it that way. And that's not all that it's about, but it's about social control and beautiful boredom and, you know...
ennui.
Things being pretty to look at and hold, you know.
Yeah.
So it's by a director, his first film. His name is Andre Antonio. Mm-hmm. It has distribution in, apparently, South America right now, but... Mm. I have a feeling that if you want to catch this, you're going to have to find it at a queer film festival.
Yeah, probably.
And it might never see the light of day in an American art house.
Yeah.
If it comes to a film festival near you, it's called The Cult. You should try it out.
I remember seeing it when they submitted it, and I liked it a lot, and I immediately thought... this might work better in the platinum section.
Explain what the platinum section is.
The platinum section is where Outfest does their more experimental cinema. So there's usually a platinum shorts program and then a couple of features. And this year, like, for example, the Legacy Project, the Outfest UCLA Legacy Project, which is which stores and restores LGBT cinema. They've got a new, like, I think a 2K high def digital restoration of Bruce LaBruce's first film, No Skin Off My Ass. And that screening in the festival partly as an Outfest Legacy Project event, but then also partly as a platinum event. But anyway, I remember watching the cult thing. I love this. This is really great. We have to show it. Maybe it should go into platinum. And the platinum curator looked at it after we pointed it out.
He introduced it and he was very excited.
And he was like, oh, yeah. So we're like, all right, fine. Yeah. You show it.
I want you to start talking. We're done with Carlo Vivari. We're done with Outfest.
Okay.
Well, I mean, in real life, you're not done with Outfest.
Outfest is still in progress.
But there are films that have come out this week.
Yes.
In release into theaters. The biggest one, neither of us have seen yet.
Correct. The Secret Life of Pets, I'm planning to catch up with.
After Outfest.
Yes.
You and I will go see it together.
Yes.
And that will be the perfect time to go because the millions and millions and millions of little children who saw it this weekend will not be there.
That's right.
And that'll be great.
Maybe we'll go to like a 9 p.m. show or something.
In the meantime, Captain Fantastic opened in limited release.
Correct.
And why don't you tell people what that is about while I go stir the dinner that's cooking okay. as we speak.
So Viggo Mortensen plays a father of six children?
Five or six.
Yeah. And they when we first see them, they this whole family is like stalking a deer through the woods and killing it. And you can't tell at first, like, are they, you know, is this some sort of island that time forgot? Like, who are these people? And then we come to realize that he basically is like sort of raising his family off the grid, you know. But they have a very sort of self-sufficient existence. They grow their own food. He, you know, the kids are all being very strenuously educated. They're all reading really advanced literature and science and history and having lengthy discussions about it. They all play musical instruments.
Annoyingly so.
So, you know, they're this isn't just like some slapdash thing. And the mother is notably absent, and we come to find out that she has been having some mental health issues. And news comes to them that she has committed suicide, and her parents have forbidden Viggo Mortensen and from attending the funeral. But the family votes, and they decide they want to go. So they all load up into the bus and head back into civilization to attend this funeral. And, you know, the movie, it's written and directed by Matt Ross, who's an actor you would recognize. He's on Silicon Valley. He was in Last Days of Disco. He was on Big Love. There are moments where you think this is going to be this really sort of sanctimonious movie about how, yeah, man, these these people are living off the land, you know, and they, you know, they got it going on, and civilization's a big bummer and whatever, you know. But as the movie proceeds, the movie also kind of gives enough rope to Viggo Mortensen to sort of say, like, well, you're kind of a jerk too, and as good a job as you're doing in a lot of ways with your children, they are not in any way prepared to live in the world as it exists, and you apparently aren't prepared to let them leave the compound and go live in that world if they choose to do so.
You got
to
pause the audio because I'm not ready to come back yet.
All right, we'll be back in a moment.
While you were explaining first of all, that was a very nice description of the movie.
Thank you. Which I saw it at Sundance and I haven't seen since January, so.
While you were doing that, I was checking on the progress, stirring the experimental dinner we're having tonight. Mm,
it's the platinum dinner.
Well, no. I don't know if either one of us is going to call it a platinum dinner, I just, you know, it's a little warm today. I didn't want to turn on the oven.
Uh-huh. Or stand over the stove for a
long time. And why is my... What's happening?
Your phone is ringing.
Why is that happening? Because... Stop it, phone! There. It's done. So I had this idea. I was in the mood to make risotto because it's one of my favorite things to make.
Right.
But I didn't want to stand over the stove for an hour stirring it. Because it's a little... Like I said, it's a little warm.
So you thought you'd take a shortcut.
Well, no. The recipe... There were many, many recipes online for slow cooker risotto. And I thought, well, they put the recipe out in the world. It must be okay.
Does it involve stirring? Risotto always involves stirring, but well, slow cookery usually doesn't.
A little bit of stirring from time to time. You know, you get to make sure it's not clumping up.
Right.
It's done. It's ready. We'll eat it when we're done with this. Recording this podcast before you have to go off to Outfest.
Right.
It tastes fine.
Okay.
But it only is good for people who've never had risotto before.
Is this a mouthfeel issue?
And don't know what it's supposed to feel like because it's a little...
Soft?
Gummy. It's still tasty. All right. It's still risotto.
Okay.
I mean, kind of. Listen, I had to try it at least once. To see if it
to know that cheater risotto isn't as good.
Yeah, it's not as good. Like, I can guarantee you right now, it's going to be like, oh, this is fine and filling.
And we're never making it again.
Then we'll never do this way again. Okay, so, Captain Fantastic, you liked this. You saw it at Sundance.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me your ideas, because
I
am not as enthusiastic.
I thought it was very funny, and I thought there
really?
Was... Really? I did, yeah.
I don't think I laughed one time. Oh, was it meant to be a comedy?
I think so, yeah. I laughed. I think the kids are all really good.
I think they are.
They were all consistently interesting, and they weren't like being, you know, adorable Muppets. I found it funny.
No, they're not obnoxious.
No. I found it funny, and I think I even might have gotten a little, you know... A little toward the end.
Where? When? What?
I saw it in January, so I don't remember.
I think the altitude of Sundance really does a number on you, honestly.
No, I do need to see it again, because even in my review that's on the wrap, I kind of caveat throughout saying, I should probably see this again at sea level before I deliver a final judgment, but I really liked it up here, you know.
I think Viggo Mortensen is the reason to see this film.
Definitely. He's great. But here's the thing. I think also in the same way that Viggo Mortensen's character could have been like Mr. Better Than Everybody and has allowed some moments of failing, you know, I think that the parents who are played by Frank Langella and Ann Dowd, the late wife's parents, could have been super two-dimensional
monsters,
and they are also allowed a certain... amount of slack.
No, you feel for them.
Yeah.
You feel for all the people who are out in the normal world.
Mm-hmm.
Catherine Hahn and Steve Zahn as the sister and brother-in-law.
Right.
What I did appreciate about the film is that Viggo Mortensen's character is not entirely right.
Yeah.
Like you just said. And the film gives you him being a complete jerk to children, not his own children, although he uses them in ways that are all about showing everyone how great he is.
Yes.
So he's kind of a, on one hand, he is a completely crappy parent. On the other hand, you really do wish there were more parents in the world who turned their kids into good leftists.
Well, and then just who paid that much attention. He's so clearly enmeshed with so much of the in and out of all of the lives of his
children. I don't just mean like indoctrinating with the party line, but teaching them like rigorously critical thinking.
Yes.
And how, you know, these kids are with the exception of all social skills, they're more equipped to handle the world than the suburban kids that we meet,
right,
who don't know anything.
Yeah.
So on one hand, that's, you know, if you are a suburban parent raising suburban children, it's a good sort of push for you to, you know, engage your kids with ideas and books and you know, teach them young to read and make it happen and
yeah, it's like
make them think.
My dad would do these dinner table conversations.
I love these stories. These are my favorite stories of you growing up. Please give us a couple.
No, just he would launch into some subject about, like, you know, how units of measure are decided or how maps are created or history things or whatever, and we would have to, like, keep up.
Right. I love that. That is not what happened in my house at all. And so, on one level, your dad was doing the thing that parents should do.
Yeah.
In a, you know, they should be pains. A parent should be a pain.
Yeah.
And making their kid, you know, hop to with some information. Like, name the 50 states. Here's, I don't know that I'm putting anyone on blast by doing this, by saying this, but your brother has a map of the United States in the little breakfast nook where the kids eat. And I have heard him and his wife ask the kids questions about the states.
Yeah.
And the kids are 3 and 4 years old. And when I saw that happening, I thought, aha, Fernando Sr. is doing the thing.
This is some Duraldi parenting.
This is some
right
Duraldi
here.
Parenting.
No, look, kids need to be armed and ready for, you know, like,
for geography questions.
Yeah, for everything. I mean, I've talked about, it's funny, Dave Holmes writes about this in his memoir. Like, you know, when you learn how to...
Did you bring that home, by the way, or did you leave it in the ironing room?
No, I brought it home.
Okay.
When you learn how to read early and you are reading ahead of the other kids in your grade, you know, that's a good thing. And we both kind of did it the same way. We watched Sesame Street, and then we had older brothers who sort of like would go over things with us. You know, I remember the same brother who has the map on the wall now.
Yes.
We had a chalkboard at home, and I remember him showing me all the phonics.
Yes.
You know, ch, sh, and th, you know.
Yeah.
I'm a big proponent of that kind of active parenting.
Anyway, so his character is given, as you said, enough rope to hang himself in the latter half of the film.
Mm.
I don't take issue with the story. I do take issue with the plotting of the script and the way that once they enter civilization, suddenly it's incident, 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 and let's steal mommy's casket and, you know, sorry, spoiler, let's steal mommy's casket. I just became increasingly annoyed at what I felt was a typical American independent film succession of, maybe tropes is the wrong word, but signposts that we get in so many of these films about quirky individualists who are, you know, having to compromise in some way or having to learn a lesson by the end of the film. And the lessons that have to be learned at the end of this film seem to come with a fair amount of ease and not much trauma, and everybody deciding, well, okay, we're going to do this. And then the soft cushion that they all get to land in at the end, they don't explain where that came from or how it came about or anything. And I was quite annoyed by the end of it. It had me at the beginning and then it lost me by the end.
I didn't mind the changes and lessons so much because everybody was so in a state of flux because of the death of the mother anyway, that I felt like their lives, and because you have one character, the oldest son, who is clearly like on the verge of like, is he going to go to college? Is he going to break away from the family unit and go do this thing? I kind of felt like they were everybody in the movie was already sort of primed for something new and different to happen anyway. So it didn't strike me as this abrupt turnaround of like, let's just throw our existing lives out the window and go to this new thing. It seemed like there was already a sort of chaos theory at play.
I do, as much as I enjoyed Viggo Mortensen's performance, I do wish that the film had maybe been a little tougher on him.
Okay.
I don't even say maybe. I wish the film had been tougher on him because his brand of authoritarianism is couched in a fairly cuddly way. And when he displays flashes of the menace that always comes with authoritarianism, whether it's conservative or liberal, I would prefer them to have explored that more deeply. I think the movie gets away with it by everyone celebrating Noam Chomsky Day. and anyone in the audience who knows who Noam Chomsky is and who likes Noam Chomsky immediately gets to pat themselves on the back for it, A, knowing that, B, having good feelings about Noam Chomsky, and C, getting excited about a film that likes Noam Chomsky. So
I didn't feel like I was being sopped too hard, but maybe that's the point of being sopped. You don't notice it.
I felt like I was being flattered. And I, you know.
But after
being read, let me tell you about something. Let me tell you a little something about flattery. After being read the worst YouTube comments about myself by friends who think it's hilarious.
YouTube comments.
I now have a greater appreciation for flattery. My favorite one. Can I tell you my favorite one?
Sure.
That guy, meaning me. That guy looks like he gets drunk every night and goes home and beats Alonzo.
Well, it's true.
You and me get along just fine.
Bottom line, though, would you recommend this movie to people?
Like, no,
really,
no.
Okay, well, I do.
This isn't a spoiler, but it's kind of a spoiler.
Then don't say
it's not much of a spoiler. It's a prop. There's a prop in the movie near the end, after they've made their soft landing. It's a lamp. It's a tall stand-up reading lamp that's been yarn bombed. It's wrapped, and the base is wrapped entirely in yarn. When I see that out in public, when people do that to statues and parking meters and stuff, I think it's adorable, and I'm very proud of it. I'm always happy to have seen it happen.
We know someone who
does it.
Yes,
and she's good at it.
Yes.
In a movie, it feels like
too twee,
too cutes, too much the cutes.
Well,
no,
I don't know what to tell
you. So when I saw that lamp, I was like, "All right, I'm done. I'm done with this movie. Done with all these."
All right, whatever, Dave White. You saw Dave and Mike Need Wedding Dates, which I did not have any interest in going to see and didn't have to. So
it is stupid, but
is it good stupid or crap stupid?
I had a good time.
All right, because I keep hearing that it's just crap stupid.
I had a good time. It's not a good film.
Okay,
but it is kind of funny. Adam Devine and Zac Efron are two bros. They're brothers and they're bros.
Right.
And they do what bros do. They go to weddings and events, stag. They get crazy. And then their parents, Stephen Root and...
Stephanie Farrisee.
Yes. They say, okay, your younger sister's getting married. Younger sister played by a woman named Sugar. I have never seen her before that I know of. I'm now looking up her name.
You had one job.
Sorry. Her name is Sugar Lynn Beard. That's her name, Sugar Lynn. She's... If you go see Dave and Mike, or Mike and Dave, whatever it's called, Mike and Dave Need Wedding Dates, pay attention to her.
I hear she's the secret weapon.
She has a baby voice to rival all cinema baby voices. It is possibly the best baby voice I've heard on a woman. I don't know if that's her real voice or if it's just what she's doing. If it is her real voice, she's made of steel. Because to have that voice means that you live your life with abuse. I guarantee you, people are harshing on you for having that voice. So she plays the younger sister getting married.
Right.
And every scene she's in, she steals it from everybody else. So they need wedding dates so that they can be calm. And they're upset about this because they know you're not supposed to bring a date to a wedding. That's not what you do. You come, if you're a bro, you go to a wedding and you...
Pick up a bridesmaid.
You pick up a bridesmaid, yeah. So they advertise on Craigslist. This really happened, by the way.
Yeah.
This is a real thing. These guys were... They decided to place a Craigslist ad as some kind of stunt. And I'm not sure what they thought they were going for with the stunt, but they did it. And they got a movie deal out of it.
Yeah, they got a book deal. The book became a movie.
So the women that they get to go with them to the wedding are... Anna Kendrick and Aubrey Plaza, who are bad, bad, bad girls. And they're pretending, faking, to be good. So they can get a free trip to Hawaii, this destination wedding. And then people get bonked on the head a lot. That's that kind of movie. When it is at its funniest is when the characters, the four of them, are all being the stupid people that they are. Because none of them are especially bright. They're all canny and they're all strategic, but they're not smart. And so their not smartness is what powers those characters being funny.
I see.
And they are funny. There's a lot of funny stuff going on in the movie. It's not meaningful. It's not relevant to anyone's, you know, existence outside the confines of an hour and 40 minutes of a comedy.
Does it at least feel like a scripted comedy as opposed to like a let's make a bunch of stuff up on the set comedy?
Maybe half and half.
I see.
There's some outtakes
at
the end where you see them going over a variety of you know, dialogue choices. It's pretty funny. It's not astonishingly funny, but it's pretty funny. I paid $14 for a matinee ticket. A matinee ticket is $14 in Los Angeles.
But you got air conditioning.
I had some air conditioning. That was nice. I recommend this if you are home and it just happens to be on cable or streaming. That is the way it should be seen. Right. It's cinematically, it's nothing. It's just a...
It's a first-time feature from like a Funny or Die guy.
I think so, yeah. And it's just it doesn't look like anything, so it's not worth a big screen.
You should come see the Doc Shorts at Outfest tonight because somebody was complaining to me last night that it was too cold in there.
Where?
DGA1.
In DGA1?
Mm-hmm.
Too cold in DGA1?
Uh-huh. Too cold is just how you like it.
Too cold is exactly how I like it. It was not too cold at the Grove when I saw Dave and Mike. Okay. It was cool enough. Mm. Yeah, I do like too cold. So anyway, this is fine. It's Aubrey Plaza. I'm a huge fan of Aubrey Plaza. I like Anna Kendrick a lot. Zac Efron, he keeps on being our best handsome comedy guy.
Yeah.
You know, if John Hamm were younger, he would have to look over his shoulder
right
at Zac Efron. He may need to look over his shoulder at Zac Efron, because you know how John Hamm, so handsome and Don Draper-ish, he shows up in these comedic films and he's quite funny.
Yeah.
Mostly television, but he'll be in, you know, movies every once in a while too. But Zac Efron has this mischief in his face.
He is so he's I don't want to say he's trying hard, because it makes it sound like you can tell that he's trying, because you can't.
He's just good at it.
But he really wants to not just be the pretty guy. And as opposed to being like Jared Leto about it, where it's like, no, I'm going to, like, you know,
I'm a serious actor.
I'm a serious actor, and I'm going to, like, do something stupid with my hair and, like, you know.
And be method.
And just try and ugly myself
up. You heard what Viola Davis said about him, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, Efron is like, no, I'm going to be as gleamy toothpaste ad as I can be, and then, like, fart. And that's going to be funny, because I'm going to be super handsome and then also just be a mess.
But it's more than that. He just farts. I've never seen him fart in a movie, but I mean,
you know what I mean.
He has a way of delivering that beautiful doofus quality. And in a way that makes it feel as though, much like in Neighbors 2, that he's constantly shocked that the world doesn't lie down in front of him and kiss his butt everywhere he goes. So it's almost like he's parodying the kind of entitlement that guys like him automatically are gifted by the world.
Right.
And I'm really, if you had said to me that while watching High School Musical 2 that this kid was going to grow up to be something worthwhile, that we all thought, oh yeah, you actually are really good at something other than being a Disney teen who can sing and dance.
Yeah.
I would have said, yeah, I don't know. I don't know about that.
Bet on it, bet on it, bet on it, bet on it. That's a thing. Anyway.
What's it a thing from, Alonzo?
High School Musical too.
I know.
Yes, he's having an interesting career, and I hope that, you know, dumb movies like this are not getting in the way of him having one.
I would like this movie to be funnier.
Mm-hmm.
But there's nothing about it that's mean.
Okay.
There's nothing about it that's, ugly. And that's different from saying that it's not a good-looking movie. It's not a good-looking movie. But it's, you know, it is a diversion. I laughed. I laughed quite a bit.
All right.
I know it's getting rotten reviews.
Yeah.
I don't know what to say to those reviews.
Do you want to talk real quick about going to see The Devils?
I would love to talk about going to see The Devils. I went to see The Devils. It was at CineFamily. And I was under the impression that I was going to get to see the uncut, uncensored version of Ken Russell's 1971 film. A film that is so controversial
to this day,
45 years later,
that
it's still banned in some places, and its company, Warner Brothers, actively seeks to squash its existence.
Yeah, it's never been out on DVD.
And it's kind of a masterpiece, and it might be Ken Russell's, you know, greatest film.
Maybe it's been on DVD. I don't want letters.
Don't quote us on any of these facts, because we don't know all of them.
They kind of hide it, though.
They do hide it. They, so much so that the woman at CineFamily got up before the screening to the packed house Although the couches have been sent out for cleaning or repair or something. It was just the seats in the back. Yeah. There's this big space in front of the theater where the couches should be. And it's, I don't know where the couches went. And I asked one of the women there, and I said, so what happened to the couches? She goes, I don't know. They weren't here when I showed up today.
Bedbugs. No, I don't know. I don't know. I'm kidding.
Well, they couldn't possibly have bedbugs because they're not fabric. They're leather couches.
Oh, good point.
Yeah. She reads a letter, and it's a letter to Warner Brothers complaining about the fact that they were sent not the print they wanted.
Right.
They were sent the 111-minute somewhat edited version.
Yeah.
Which, you know what? If that's the only version you can see it anyway, because it is an incredible film. It's about, what it's about is a true story that actually happened. It took place in 17th century France, in the town of Loudun. A Roman Catholic priest, Grandier was his last name, and a convent of Ursuline nuns, who were sort of in his thrall. And as played by Oliver Reed, you can understand why. One of the women, one of the nuns, actually says in the beginning of the film, there's a man worth going to hell for. And I was like, well, yes, of course.
Is it before or after
of
women?
Of course he gets to have sex with all of you. Look at him. He's Oliver Reed.
Is this before or after Women in Love?
Just after Women in Love.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was like 69, I think.
Yeah. And the nuns allegedly in this convent all became possessed by demons after Grandier made a pact with Satan. Well, none of these things happened. This was a situation where the political powers of the region, they wanted him out because he was against them. I'm greatly simplifying this story, and it's a complicated story of power that is corrupting not only from the state, but also from the church, and how the two collude, and the power that men have over women, and the power of any institution at the time to say simply something along the lines of, well, that woman bewitched me with her powers, with her sensual powers. That means she's got a demon and she's a witch and we must burn her. That kind of thing. So these are ultimately Grandier's burned at the stake. This is all true. It's based on a book by Aldous Huxley called The Devils of Loudun, which I went and bought the minute I was finished watching the movie. I cannot wait to dig right into this book. I had never quite understood the fact that this was a true story. And so now I'm completely fascinated by it. This movie is out of control. First of all, Ken Russell has always been
Baroque.
A maximalist.
That's a good description.
Baz Luhrmann suckled at the breast milk of Ken Russell. Okay? Everything you might dislike about Baz Luhrmann, that complete, grandiose, ornate everything, 17 things happening on screen at once, you can blame Papa Ken Russell for that. He had a particular filmmaking style that lent itself to histrionics, screaming, wild group scenes of violence or sex or both at the same time.
Visual extravagance.
Yeah, just...
The art director on this film, by the way, was Derek Jarman, his first movie gig.
Who turned to this 16th century historical small town made of mud bricks. Let's just be real. It turned it into this fantasy of white tile that just, you know, pops. Everything pops off the camera. Everything pops off this tile. And so the camera is just collecting beautiful, grotesque imagery as it's set against this ornate production design. And then there's Vanessa Redgrave as the Mother Superior with a hunchback who, you know, she enters the movie through a door and she's like, turn to the side. And the women are all staring out the window at Oliver Reed like you do. And she's like, Satan is ever ready to seduce us with sensual delights. Meanwhile, she got a big crush on him too and has these like rape fantasies about him. And the edited version that I witnessed, you can see the unedited bits, not all of them, but a few of them on YouTube and in a documentary that the BBC made about the film that is available entirely on YouTube. And it's pretty crazy stuff. And I understand why a stupid religious person would have a problem with these metaphorical enactments of what is essentially, you know, the rape of culture, the rape of the church. I use this word because that is what these powers were doing to each other. And so when you see a nun orgy that has been excised from the film, you see that little clip of it on YouTube, you know, you get it thematically. But if you are a dummy who doesn't understand, you know, literary devices,
right,
then you're going to be, Ken Russell thinks none should have orgies, you know. So there's no teaching stupid people this kind of thing. Because if you're a grown-up and you haven't learned it yet, then chances are
you're beyond.
You're not volunteering to go back to school to relearn the things you voluntarily chose to ignore.
Right.
It is an incredible film.
I want to see it. I keep missing it, but it's been popping up a bunch lately, so hopefully I will get my chance. What's your DVD pick this week?
Glad you asked, because I forgot to get one. I'm just going to read some letters. Do you have a DVD release?
Yeah, my DVD pick, well, because we were talking about Frank Langella in Captain Fantastic, and I think he's just always great, and a movie that I think he's really, really terrific in that very few people saw is The Box, which is Richard Kelly's third film.
Yes.
He had a huge cult success with Donnie Darko, and then a big, giant belly flop with Southland Tales.
Which is a really cool movie.
And then The Box, which is one of the handful of movies to receive an F cinema score, but I think it's really great. And it's also a Christmas movie. It's my book.
I'm a fan.
Yeah, The Box is nutty, and it's loosely based on a Richard Matheson story that was turned into a Twilight Zone episode, but that only takes up about the first half hour of the film. And Frank Langella is just so creepy and chilling in this movie. It's definitely worth seeing.
I uncovered a few letters in the email file.
Okay.
That are from April. So, maybe you remember sending us an email in April. Maybe you don't. I'm fixing to read a couple of them.
Welcome to July.
This is from Ben.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, if y'all have reviewed this in the past few weeks, please pardon my asking, as I just started a new job that broke my routine and has me traveling, so my podcast listening has shifted a little. Compadres, which neither of us
saw. No, I missed it.
The trailer makes it look pretty awesome, but as we know from your guest, that is less art and more science these days. When he's talking about
Bill Neal,
our guest Bill, that came on the show.
Yeah.
Number two, this is the weirdest limited release situation I have seen. This film is on one screen in one multiplex in our entire region in the more conservative part of town. This is the theater that usually gets runs of those Christian films that Dave likes to go see. For example, it is the only theater currently still screening God's Not Dead 2. My theory is that it is related to the continued ease of showing films with digital distribution and studios strong-arming films onto screens. The theater is in an enclosed regional shopping mall near a suburb with traditionally high incomes, so it is also playing a few other artsy films like, oh, the TCM night where they screened On the Waterfront with Ben introducing, and Hello, My Name is Doris.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I know Compadres is one of those Pantelion films.
Yeah.
But it's mainly aimed at a Hispanic, you know, Latino / Spanish speaking U.S. audience. So it's interesting they would be showing it there. But, you know, that may just be that's the one theater in town where smaller distribution companies can get their stuff in.
This one's from Urso.
Okay.
Many thanks for a great podcast and all that stuff that you're supposed to say before a list of 10 movies. Here's his list. I can only honestly defend 8 of them, but they all mean something to me on one level or another. I'll be interested in y'all's take.
All right.
I expect to be 80% knife.
Okay.
We'll be the judge of this. The Up series.
Well, sure.
All of them. He says it's several movies, of course. I first saw 28 Up when I was 17, and my whole life since, I found myself wondering what's going on in their lives. Every 7 years, I get to find out. 56 Up came out in 2012. Michael Apted has said that if he's still alive, there will be a 63 Up relatively soon. So much of what I understand about the human condition is shown in these movies. Seeing decades of interviews really does give a completely new perspective on people. You know, those people that aren't yourself.
I'm embarrassed to say I've never seen any of the Up films.
Really?
Yeah.
I haven't seen all of them, but I've seen a few.
So I've got three. Yeah. I've got 3 years to get ready for 63 Up.
Yeah. 2001: A Space Odyssey. I could say a bunch of deep, meaningful things about this movie and what it means to me, but it's all been said before, more eloquently. Except this: my dream home is a cross between the spaceship Discovery and Space 1999's Moonbase Alpha. Little Murders from 1971.
Oh, yeah.
I have not seen it.
That is, I think, the only film that is directed by Alan Arkin. It stars Elliot Gould. It's based on a Jules Feiffer play. You'd like it. It's a dark comedy.
He says, I saw this as a 9-year-old in the theater. I recently rewatched it, and it is a truly dark, dark comedy. Who lets a little kid watch this? Xanadu.
Yeah.
Wrong.
Oh, come on.
Airplane.
Sure.
Koyaanisqatsi.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, I sure do love that Koyaanisqatsi.
Oh, yeah.
The Player.
Yeah.
Boogie Nights.
Yeah. I'm not the biggest fan, but it's, you know.
This encapsulates that era around 1980 when it seems like everything changed. In 1997, I briefly worked as a designer for an adult media company. There were times at work when I'd have sudden flashes back to scenes in the movie, but it's also worth noting that the only Generation X person depicted in the whole movie is a child calling a drug-fueled party trying to find his mother. Thomas in Love. It's a film from 2000. It's a Belgian sci-fi movie.
Well, I got nothing.
I don't know it. And Tomorrowland from 2015.
Ew, no.
I love this movie not so much because of what it is, but for what it could have been. All right, that doesn't count.
Yeah, no, that's an everyone gets a trophy kind of thing. I mean, I agree with you. I like some of what it has to say and its potential, but it does not make any of it work.
One of my careers is as a World's Fair historian and consultant.
Well, sure, obviously. That's going to be right up your
alley. I saw this movie in an Italian movie theater last year while I was working at Milan's Expo 2015. sadly, few Americans know that World's Fairs still happen, and the movie, ironically, reinforces this view while simultaneously challenging the audience to be more optimistic and thoughtful about the future. If they did remakes of bad movies to fix them, I'd urge them to give this one another try. Okay, so you're 85% knife. How's that, or so?
What are you not giving him?
Well,
besides Xanadu.
Tomorrowland.
Oh, Tomorrowland and Xanadu?
Yeah.
All right, okay. 85, yeah. So
you're giving him you're giving him Xanadu, I know.
I give him Xanadu, sure.
Because you're a Xanaduer.
I'm a Xanadude.
This is from Douglas, sound
Douglas
of the century. Subject line, listeners. Knives are stored in blocks. Therefore, a block of LK listeners.
Maybe a block without a K.
Maybe a block without a C.
I don't know. We'll keep working on it.
This is from Jim. Same subject. Howdy. On this week's episode, you asked for a title for the Linoleum Knife Army. What instantly came to my mind for me was Linoleum Knights. K, with a K.
Right.
So I figured I may as well send that in. Oh, wait. It says it's from Jim, but he signs it Peter.
Huh.
Well, I'm now confused about who you are.
Thanks, Jim Peter. Yeah, that sounds too much like Baywatch Knights.
Well, then now you just made me like it. This is from Alina, who I don't think we've heard from before.
Okay.
Hello, Dave and Alonzo. I know I'm a week late. Last week, I attended a film festival, which sadly cut heavily into my podcast listening time. I'm a fairly new listener, only starting in the beginning of this year through What the Flick. Your podcast quickly became one of my favorites. I really have to thank Dave for recommending Frederick Wiseman and Hu Hsiao-hsien. I'm now watching my way through their filmographies and having a great time with it. As you were curious about who your other listeners are and where and what their deal is, I'm a 22-year-old engineering student from Germany. Have we had anyone write in from Germany yet?
Maybe not.
And I work part-time in a small independent cinema after bonding with the owner over... After bonding.
Bonding.
She spells it bounding. After bonding with the owner over our shared love for Jim Jarmusch on the opening night of Only Lovers Left Alive. At the previously mentioned festival, I saw The Witch, and I can agree with the two of you. I can agree with all the two of you said about it. Also, I saw The Lobster and Green Room. I really loved both of them, and I hope to hear your thoughts on it at some point. So, because this was in April,
we have talked about both of them.
Particularly Dave's ideas about Green Room, due to its heavy reference on hardcore punk culture. I'm sure he can provide some insights. I don't know that I had any special insights other than that, yeah, Nazis still exist in the American hardcore punk scene, which is weird. The neo-Nazis, the white power people, they still are a thing.
What were they going to do, gravitate to hip-hop?
I don't know. I wish they'd gravitate to
non-existence.
A different place on the planet, maybe a different planet. Also, I have to agree with Sarah from Finland on the vegan junk food. It is awesome and does not deserve to be badmouthed. In the tradition of list knifing, here is mine in no particular order, Dr. Strangelove.
Yeah.
Paris, Texas.
Oh, nice.
Which I really adore.
Yeah.
Rebecca, Dead Man.
Never seen it.
Jim Jarmusch's Dead Man is so good. Holy Motors.
Love it.
Oh, Alina. You're my new favorite person. Oh, Hassard Baltasar. Ron, The Exorcist, Annie Hall, and M. Alina, you are 100% wow. Knife.
Yeah, no question.
That's all for now. Best wishes.
Nice.
Thank you, Alina.
Hang on, I'm going to pause for a second. Okay.
Well, that's it.
Oh, all right.
Then. Yeah.
Did you want to talk about membership?
Why don't you join our club?
Yeah.
It costs you $4 per month or more if you choose to subscribe for more items and more content. Go to Patreon. Go to Patreon, patreon.com. And then enter the words linoleum knife.
Patreon.com/linoleum knife.
Or you could do it that way.
All one word. It's much easier.
And then what'll pop up is a little video of you and me talking about the things that you get when you join the club. And then on the page is a whole list of the things you get depending on what you subscribe at.
Yes.
And you should subscribe for if no other reason than to get LKTV, which is the podcast of the television that we do every week. And we're pretty
great.
Yeah.
It helps us, you know, exist and put on this program and put on the other program. You know, we're delighted that we have so many listeners who feel invested in the show.
All right, you're going on and on about it.
Oh, excuse.
So let's just say goodbye.
Excuse me, Dave White.
We gave our pitch. Thanks for the people who are already subscribing.
Yes. If you're a member of our club, you're awesome. And if you become one, you will be awesomer than you already are. So thank you all for listening. Check out our friends on the internet. Go to ChristyLemire.com. Listen to the B-Movies podcast and Canceled Too Soon with Bibbs and Whitney, The Schmoes Know, and Dennis Ended with Dennis Hensley and The Comics Canon, and the Rotten Tomatoes podcast with Matt and Gray and Sewers of Paris and the Joel Ryan thing and the Brady Sinellis podcast. And Fat Guys of the Movies, the Criterion Cast, Film Spotting, SVU, the Game Night Guys, and Secretly Timid. Thank you, Blue, for our wonderful theme music. Bluetopia.com, BLEUTOPIA. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at LinoleumCast. If you have an Android, you can also stream us on Google Play. And anybody can stream us on Stitcher Radio or TheLounge.com. Drop us a line at LinoleumPodcast@gmail.com with any questions or comments. And we know we still have letters to catch up on. We are going to get to those, I promise. And I guess that's it. Next week, I've still got Outfest going on all this week, but I'm hoping by next Sunday I'll have seen some other. Well, I'll definitely have seen Ghostbusters.
Yes,
that's we're showing that Wednesday night.
Me too.
At the Ford Theater as part of Outfest, so that's going to be great. And yeah, so until then, we'll catch you next time.
Goodbye.